Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lost in Science. We are so glad that you're here to get lost with us. Don't get lost in that Christmas list. Don't get lost in the supermarket. Just be lost in science with us. My name is Lyndon and joining me today I have Chris. Hello Chris, how are you?
I am good, thanks Lyndon. Well, you know, good as can be expected when things are there are bad things happening in the world. Let's be frank. We're not here to talk about the worst things in the world, I guess.
No,
but
no.
Some less good things.
It's a funny time of year, isn't it? When you kind of things are winding up and you're thinking about all the things I've done. I'm grateful for this, that, and the other thing. But it's important to acknowledge that there are also some hard things happening as well. So I'm glad to hear that you are as good as can be expected. Given what's going on in the world and actually given what we're going to talk about in the show today, huh?
That's kind of what I was alluding to, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't going to talk about some of the other worst stuff, you know.
In the world of science, you want to...
Yeah, yeah.
What do you want to talk about today?
I want to talk about some news that people might have heard about recently, the latest kind of rounds of funding cuts to the CSIRO is the main thing, but it's caused a lot of reflection on just the state of research funding in this country. You know, we talk a lot in this show about everyone is obsessed with that orange man, the orange tyrant, the Donald Trump over in the US, and you know, we talked about I guess some of the policies there and even the effect that it's had on Australian researchers as well, but really we should be looking at what's going on in this country too, and you know, that's more directly affects local science. So yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's trying to get a picture of where things are at and where the gaps are, I suppose.
It's a really important topic to discuss. If we don't have researchers, if we don't have funding for research, then science can't get done. And
we don't have a radio show.
We don't have a radio show. Not only do we not have important developments in how we understand the world and how we make lives better for people, but we don't have a show. We can't have that.
Think of us.
Exactly. We are also joined by Claire today, and Claire is going to be interviewing an associate professor from Flinders University whose name is Jochen Kempf. Jochen is an oceanographer, and he's been studying in detail this algal bloom, this awful algal bloom that's been unfolding in the South Australian region in the, I think it's the St. Vincent Gulf. It's about 30% of the South Australian coastline that's affected, and it's just not letting up. And Claire and Jochen are going to talk all about it. It's a really useful chat, I think, to deep dive, if you'll excuse that pun, into the science behind this bloom, why it is just not clearing, what the outlook is for the next few months as we come into the warmer part of the year, and yeah, what the future holds for this important part of the world. So stick around for some serious but important science.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. That's the signpost up ahead. Your next stop...
Lost in Science.
All right, yes, you are listening to Lost in Science, and we are talking about research funding in this country that we call Australia. And as I said in the introduction, there was recently announced some further job cuts to the CSIRO. This was 350 research jobs this time. There had been like another 800 or so other jobs that were mostly non, like directly not research. Those are the past 18 months, but then their 350 research jobs were announced in October, I believe. And this has caused a bit of concern. I feel like not as much concern as perhaps some of these similar cuts in the past have. Maybe we're all like a bit, I don't know, battle hardened.
Yeah, I remember when they cut a lot of climate science jobs, there was protests and a lot of professional societies kind of getting behind the researchers who were affected, maybe because it, has CSIRO kind of said specifically which regions, which areas of research are getting affected?
Not that I've been able to find out, no. But you're right, there was a lot of concern about climate in particular. So the first big ones were basically in 2014 to 2015, thereabout. That was under the Abbott government, when Tony Abbott was Prime Minister. About 1,400 jobs in total, I believe, were estimated to have been cut then. Then in 2016, the Turnbull government, so when we were cycling through Prime Ministers like they were, you know, going out of fashion, which they were. They cut another 350 jobs in 2016. And there were protests in the street then. I was trying to look back through the news stories. And yeah, that last one, the Turnbull ones, yeah, there was like a lot of people got behind the scientists at that point. This is a similar scale, I mean, bigger or smaller depending on how you count, but it seemed to have led to the same level of outcry, I suppose. I don't know whether it's because, you know, which side of politics you're on, or if there are other things like algal blooms and other things happening in the world people be concerned about. I mean, if you think back to, you know, 2015, 2016, probably there was a lot of nicer things in the world than what we're dealing with now. But yeah, I feel like it's also, though, as I said, maybe a bit of we're all sort of used to it. And by now, this is an ongoing situation where the funding has been declining. That's not entirely true, as you know, the kind of accounting with these things works. Apparently the funding for the CSIRO in particular has grown over the past 15 years or so by an average of about 1.3% per annum.
Mm-hmm.
But as we all know, inflation has been a lot higher. It's probably closer to 3%, probably more like 2.7%. So you're really, just by inflation, the costs are not keeping, the funding increase is not keeping pace with the rising costs. And, you know, as technology increases as well, there is more stuff to do. Often research does cost more because there is more things that you need to do. So, yeah, it has been a real, I guess, in terms of real money, it has been a decrease in funds, which is what the organisation is giving its reason for.
Mm.
Talk about sustainability, which is ironic when you're talking about, as you said, often it's like climate jobs and things are cut, but they mean their economic sustainability, I suppose.
I wonder how much, you say that there hasn't been as much outcry. Maybe we just haven't paid attention, like you say, because there's so many other things going on. But purely speculating here, I remember when Doug Hilton, who's the chief executive of CSIRO, when he took over, he was at WEHI, I think, Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, and he's a scientist by training. Remember when he took over and he really defended CSIRO? He really went into bat for them, and particularly the renewable energy
mm-hmm.
report that they put out. I remember Peter Dutton kind of saying it was fake, and then Doug Hilton saying, get out of town, it's not fake, you know, this is the research, this is the science. I wonder if perhaps he's got a little bit more rope than possibly Gary Marshall, who's the previous chief, had, because he wasn't very well, maybe wasn't as well liked, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, It's look, this has actually been pointed to by some people saying how the attitudes towards some of the work that CSIRO does, particularly the area, has changed with the new government, but the dollars coming through has not kind of kept up. But look, they're not the only game in town. Generally, research funding in Australia is low compared to comparable countries and does seem to be going down. We have there was analysis I found from Nature Journal last year where they were looking at the state of research in Australia, and we have slipped in the world rankings over the past few years.
In the quality of our research output?
They're more looking at the level of funding
that
is given to research compared to similar countries, I suppose. And look, I found different kind of calculations of the figure. The figure that's most commonly quoted is that like the OECD average for research is about, the percentage of GDP is about 2.2%, I think it is, and we're about 1.6%.
Yeah, wow.
So we're lagging well behind. One of the things that stands out, which the government is doing a kind of a review of this stuff at the moment, and they point to the fact that, like, the big thing where we're lagging is private funding, like industry funding for research, is just not there in Australia, which is, you know, we rely mostly on government funding. Particularly, there is some, like, at least some research in small to medium-sized businesses, but the big industries here don't seem to put in a lot of funding compared to comparable countries, which means the government then kind of picks up the slack. You know, there's always this focus on with organizations like CSIRO about applied research, very practical industry-focused research, as opposed to, I suppose, fundamental or pure research, which is more like your discovery kind of stuff. But that seems to be largely because, yeah, the businesses are not pulling their weight. But even, like I said, the government funding is declining as well. Even if you look at, say, it's Nelson Nature that looked at the big funding bodies in Australia, which was, like, obviously the National Health and Medical Research Council and the Australian Research Council. NHMRC funding has declined over the last few years in real money. ARC has gone up slightly, but not by necessarily to counter the NHMRC. So the overall funding is going down. It was interesting, though, looking. This is the fun thing I found funny. You know, as I said, there was a concern earlier in the year with the Trump administration's policies and saying, you know, Australian researchers are getting money from the US and that was going to be cut off with their policies. Apparently, in terms of our funding sources in Australia, you have things like, yeah, I said, the NHMRC, the ARC, you have the Medical Research Future Fund, which is also another big funder. That was actually an Abbott government initiative, so we can thank him for that as well. But then coming after that one is the European Commission. We actually get a lot of money, it seems, from Europe rather than America necessarily. So we do rely on overseas funding, again, perhaps because it's not coming locally, I suppose.
God. And then meanwhile, you think about researchers. I've got a lot of colleagues applying for schemes from the Australian Research Council and the NHMRC in the last couple of weeks who have found out that they've been unsuccessful, that they've spent 3 months full-time essentially working on a grant application that will hopefully pay for them to do research for the next 3 years. The success rates for the different schemes are between 7% and 13% or something. Yeah. And the amount of wasted hours of those on those grant applications, it's pretty inefficient.
And the job stability is not there. How, you know, difficult being a researcher when the job stability is not there, relying on this unreliable sources of funding. So, yeah, look, it's not a great situation. But as I said, this is kind of trends that have been going on for many years. You know, I've named several governments there. You know, it's basically governments of all stripes there, you know, and they identify the problem. They do reviews. They identify the problem that this funding is decreasing. But the money is just not being put, I guess, where it needs to go to actually reverse these trends. So, you know, it's fine for them to support science, I suppose, in principle, but if they don't actually prioritize it in terms of funding decisions, then it is just going to go away. You know, we are seeing more. We can't rely on the Europeans to fund us forever. We have to pull our own weight in these things.
Amen.
I'm Maggie Adairan-Pocock, and you're listening to Lost in Science on 3CR.
So the devastating algal blooms in South Australia have left biodiversity imperiled, industry under pressure, and the way of life for South Australians all under stress, and more than 87,000 animals dead. But what do we know about the algal blooms since they began in March 2025, and what lies ahead for this catastrophic algal bloom, especially in the lead up to summertime? To give us the scientific insights we need to understand this disaster, we have oceanographer and associate professor Jochen Kempf from Flinders University. Jochen, welcome to Lost in Science.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
I'm good. It's wonderful to have you here as an expert in this space. Can you talk to us about what is happening in South Australian waters right now?
It's a very turbulent story with dramatic changes almost on a daily or sometimes on a weekly basis, you know, because it is an unprecedented algae bloom. It has never happened. And there was always the promise of what we were told, that it will go away within weeks or within months. But maybe to give it a little bit of a very basic scientific background. So we're talking actually about algae, microscopic cells, if you like, plants in the ocean that don't eat other animals, but they essentially convert light into sugars, taking up carbon. So that's the floating marine plants in the ocean. And there are thousands of them. And most of them are actually good. They actually support an ecosystem, a marine ecosystem. And we are so lucky in South Australia because we have something which is known as an upwelling system, where nutrients go into the surface, create heaps of phytoplankton, we call it, that these plants, these algae, and that's the starting point for the entire wonderful marine ecosystem that we have, from whales to sharks to, you know, the cuttlefish that we have in the Upper Spencer Gulf. But there are toxic algae, there are harmful algae. And what we're now having since March, for more than 8 months, is a very nasty, toxic algae that actually can kill other marine life. It's toxic to fish, it's toxic to shellfish, and it has been around for 8 months. And my role in this entire story is that I, very early on, I used a computer model, and actually from my knowledge, I learned about South Australia's gulfs, the Spencer Gulf and Gulf St. Vincent. I learned about the flushing and the currents, and I was the first to actually predict that the algae bloom will not go away. It might become weaker, but then re-intensify. And so that was the first, I would say, big warning signal to decision makers, politicians, and so on.
So you say this hasn't happened before. What are the factors that have led us to this situation?
There are some suggestions, you know, but I'm a scientist. I don't know the cause, or we don't know the cause. You know, if you ask the government, they say, oh, there was a strong upwelling event, there was a Murray River flood or marine heat wave. What the listeners should know, that this particular algae, so all algae, different species are different. And this particular algae, which is, we thought first, it's the Karenia micimotoi, is actually an algae that can grow in a wide temperature range. It can grow in cold water. It can grow in warm water. So it doesn't need any particular trigger. So it's not that you need a marine heat wave and then it kicks off. You know, it can grow under many, many different conditions, you know. And I mean, the story is very, very complex, because we now actually learned that there's another algae involved, also Karenia, but it's called Cristata. And that's the nasty one, because it produces so-called brevetoxins, which impact humans, which impact public health.
Right. So there's okay. two and toxic also, algae now.
Yeah. And also that species can survive in fairly cold water. And that's why the algae is still around, you know, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't disappear if it gets colder. And this is different to other algae. Well, maybe the listeners have heard about blue-green algae that you get during summer in river. And so, you know, that they disappear once it gets colder. But this one does not disappear, which becomes now very, very apparent.
Where is the algal bloom currently affecting? And is it spreading?
It's in the entire Gulf of St. Vincent. So we have two gulfs in South Australia. The bigger one is called Spencer Gulf. You know, it's sort of 300 kilometers long or so. And the smaller one is the Gulf of St. Vincent. And Gulf of St. Vincent is where Adelaide is located. And in that one gulf, is the algae has spread, you know, and affects the entire region. And from the beginning, I mean, it started actually outside the gulfs, you know, on the southern coast of the Eyre Peninsula near Victor Harbour, then became moved into the Gulf and then spread in one Gulf only so far. But my model predicts that it will impact the other Gulf, the Spencer Gulf as well in next year. So hopefully it will not happen, you know, because that's the big concern, because we have the giant Australian cuttlefish in the upper Spencer Gulf near Whyalla. And there's also large, I mean, the algal bloom already has killed millions of, more than millions of species. Not the one that I list as the one that, you know, in iNaturalist you can list and take photos or so. But now, just last week, you go along the beach and there are thousands of small dead fish. And this is 8 months after the algae bloom has started. It's absolutely shocking.
The scale of the algal bloom is huge, and the effects that we're seeing, its toxicity across the board for any marine life, is that more specifically for fish?
It is for most. I mean, we've seen a number of dead sharks on the beaches, so that it affects mammals. It goes right through the marine food chain, you know, and we don't know what can actually control it, whether there's some other zooplankton species that can feed from it, you know. It's also known to impact birds as well, you know. It can kill birds, you know, and we're not sure whether it will actually go away, because once that's the big question: how did it get there? And we don't know, because it's not this species that they found now is not natural. It's not natural to the system. And sometimes what can happen is that the ship ballast water, the water that's released by ships, might be infested coming from other regions and starting an algae bloom. But there are some other scientists say, this algae is too sensitive. If you pump it into the sea, it would die. It would, you know, but I'm not sure. We have no clue where it comes from. It has never been recorded before. It will probably never go away, you know, because it's, you know, it's just maintaining itself. But it's the algae itself is not, it's not from outer space, you know. It's often new algae species are discovered, but they might actually be part of something that happened in the past, but which just couldn't be identified. So you have to be a little bit careful in terms of scientifically, you know, because there's new things discovered almost every week as well.
And you talked about that you're leading research on modeling these algal blooms. How is that research changing, and how has it changed over the last 8 months? Are there sort of like interventions that you're modeling, or management techniques, or?
It's actually, the modeling has changed a big way, because originally we thought it's the Carinia mikimotoi species, which has been reported for over 100 years in different regions, has started in Japanese waters and so on. And that is pretty well understood. And we know, and this is the key to the modeling, is if you know what the growth rate is. So the growth rate tells you, it depends on the temperature, for example. It depends on ambient nutrient conditions, you know. And once you know that formula, then you can actually put it into a model and you can simulate, you can predict. Okay, and with that, the model actually predicted that the algae bloom will weaken significantly over winter. And what we surprising was, it did not in the observations. Observations showed high number, the highest number, through the entire winter time, until they found out that it's actually a different species, not mikimotoi. The levels are really low, like predicted in my model, but the other species has a very high level. So what now the idea is, and we don't know much about the growth rate of that other species, but what the idea is, maybe in winter when it's colder, the water, one species gets to big, high concentrations. And then in summer, the other species goes to high concentration. It's like a yo-yo. One goes up, the other one goes down, you know? And that's really shocking, but we don't know how they benefit from each other because there are several species involved in that. We call it a mix of algae, and maybe they benefit from each other, you know? And so that gives so much new material for new research, you know? And that's the important thing, going out, you know, doing measurements and trying to understand.
There isn't any precedent around the world for these types of algae to interact and create a similar sort of response?
No, not about how they interact, but there's lots of knowledge about other Carinia species, the Brevis species in California that causes a, you know, damage over a long time already. But what makes it special here in Australia is, and maybe some of your listeners actually don't know, that we have the South Australian Gulfs are inverse estuaries. They're like the Persian Gulf. They're different. It's not like a river. We don't have much rainfall in South Australia. So these systems, there are just extensions to the ocean, sort of isolated, sheltered. But because of the evaporation, the waters are hypersaline, saltier than the ambient water. And because of that, we have a very, very special ecosystem around this salty environment, more salty than seawater environment. And because of that also, the regions have a very slow flushing. They're sort of like lake environments. If you have something in, it can be a pollutant, it can be, you know, some sewage or whatever you think of, or in toxic algae, if you just ignore that, it can actually grow back. It would take maybe 1 or 2 years to actually flush it out. And that's the dramatic thing. It's like a lake type system. And once you have something in there, it's terrible, you know?
Now, Jochen, it feels like time is of the essence and there's a lot of science to do. And, you know, our lawmakers and our representatives should be listening to the scientists in this situation. You know, with your modelling and your expertise, what do you think should be the focus for our representatives and our lawmakers?
The issue in South Australia is there's an election coming up in a few months, and there's a lot of political spin. I think there is not much sense at the moment, because there's on 1 week the premier comes out and says the algae bloom is not toxic, and then they find a new brevet toxin. It's sort of, you know, it's really about, oh, there was statements also, the government says, oh, now it's time, it will actually disappear, you know. But just today was reports of big sea foam, you know, you look like you're having a bath with bubble bath and blowing and foam. And we know from measurements that this sea foam is actually contains the toxins that are impacting humans, and the wind washing it over the cars and towards the houses. The algae bloom is definitely there, but the hope for the government is to say, oh, it's over. So it's a parallel universes at the moment here in Adelaide. But coming back to your question, if the algae bloom goes away without any measurements, we wouldn't even understand why. Why did it go away? Because the risk is that it can actually potentially spread to other regions around Australia. You know, we know that from Chinese waters, it moved from one region to another. It could spread into Bass Strait, it could spread to the west. And so the more you understand now about what's happening here, the better you're prepared for the other regions, you know, if it spreads. And what you need to do is go out, do regular measurements, and it's essentially doing about cell counts. You go out, take measurements, cell counts, try to understand which species has higher numbers. You know, I talked about there are different species, which one dominates, going into the lab and measuring try to get the growth rates, you know, to understand whether one species grows better in cold water. But in the end, there is very little that you can do. You know, there's some spin saying you can do some artificial reefs or so, but I mean, we're talking about Gulf St. Vincent is 150 kilometers long or so, something like that. 120, maybe 30, 40 across, 20 meters. It's massive, massive region, and having a little bit of an artificial reef, you know, it's like a little drop on a hot rock, which just disappears, you know? So we have to hang on and do measurements as best as we can.
Jürgen, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for your insights, your advocacy for scientific research and monitoring of this ecological catastrophe that's happening in South Australia.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.